you all for coming on this rainy Friday. We're really glad so many are here. And I am here, you all know me, I think, Carolyn Hughes from Special Ed and Zero Time over here. And Claire Smirker, who is from the Department of LPO, Leadership Policy and Organization.
Yes, that's our current name.
Yeah, the name of the day, yeah. And I don't know if you all know this, but Claire and I are in the same cohort because we came to Vanderbilt the very same year, 15 years ago.
Right.
And Joe hired us.
I hired
he
yes.
Was, he was the
he
dean.
He gave us the big contract.
That's what he was. That's what it was. And of the eight or so that came in, mm-hmm. there are only four of us left. All women, mind you.
Where are the other two?
Ellen Goldring and
Marcy. Gabella.
Yep. And how Claire and I got going on this, actually I've been wanting to collaborate with Claire on some stuff for a long time, and about a year and a half ago, Claire and I ran into each other crossing the parking lots, and I was just coming back from a family resource center in a community center in the Sam Levy housing development. And I had just been at a providers meeting at that community center. And Claire and I were talking about, well, you know, what's going on here in Nashville? Hope 6 is coming in, and I had just come from a Hope 6 meeting where we were talking about Sam Levy was finally getting finished, and families were moving in, and Claire said, well, you know, I am in the midst of applying for this grant that's looking at the effects of Hope 6 restructuring on neighborhood schools, and that's a big interest of mine, and so we decided to go with this. Now, Claire has a great history with Spencer funding. In fact, she's gotten two so far. So two out of three ain't bad, you guys, but I came in on the last one here, and I think maybe the playing field has changed, and maybe that's what we ran into. We got through the door with this particular application to Spencer, in that they thought it was a great idea. But then when we sent it out to reviewers, we got mixed reviews, and we're still playing around with it and want to send it out for funding, of course. And that is why we are here today. We want to present this to you. We want to get feedback from you on what it is. How can we tweak this? Are we looking at the right things? Are we looking at the right funding agencies? And whatever help you can offer us will be really great. So let's brainstorm together. And here's how we're going to work it. I'm going to turn it over to Claire, who's going to talk about the conceptual framework, our research questions, and so forth. And then I'll talk about the methodology that we propose. And as we go along, please, if you have questions, you have comments, as long as you're not too tough, because you have a reputation as a rough crowd around here. So we'll have to shut you off if it gets out of hand. But as long as we can handle it.
We can.
Okay, there's Claire.
Okay, thanks, Carolyn. I might ask you to, if you want to sit there and move the PowerPoint along as I get started. Thank you all for coming on an obviously kind of dreary, a very wet day. I really appreciate it, and appreciate your interest in the topic and any feedback you can offer on this proposal that we're quite excited about. We hope to find a funder, and what we're thinking about now is the Russell Sage Foundation. I'd like to give you a little bit of background how I started on this project. And it's helpful, I think, particularly for grad students to understand kind of progression of projects. And this idea started or was hatched through earlier research that I was conducting here in Metro Nashville Public Schools as part of a study of desegregation in Metro Nashville. Beginning in 2001, we were awarded a grant from the William T. Grant Foundation, my colleague Ellen Goldring and myself, to examine the effects, the aftermath of the end of court-ordered busing in Nashville to a system of neighborhood schools, more magnet schools, and enhanced option schools. Ellen took the lead on the survey research, and I took the lead on the qualitative case studies. So I launched in 2001 a 3.5-year project to examine the impact of this new plan on the development of new magnet schools and how parents gain access to those magnet schools and issues of excellence and equity and authenticity, and to examine these, what are called by the district, enhanced option schools. These are schools that are located now in high poverty neighborhoods. Under court order, the mix of those schools was balanced by race under the court order. There was also a bit of balance by socioeconomic class. After the court order was ended and moved to unitary status, the district went basically to a neighborhood school attendance policy. Well, that meant, of course, that those neighborhood schools, those schools located in neighborhoods of high poverty, became overnight essentially high poverty schools, many or most of them. So the district, in their wisdom, and I think with a strong bipartisan agreement, said, well, if we're going to have high poverty, socially isolated schools, in order for those kids to succeed, we have to enhance those schools. So the idea was to establish wraparound social and health services in those schools, establish a summer program for those children, and lower the pupil-teacher ratio in those schools to 15 and 1. So smaller class size, longer school year, social and health services. So my project then under the William T. Grant Foundation study was to examine those two types of schools, magnet schools and enhanced option schools. Well, two of the enhanced option schools I started to explore and continued over 3 years, it turns out had very different portraits once I got deeper into the neighborhood. The free and reduced lunch rates at these two schools are very close, 92% and 82%. So that's a gross measure we typically use when we examine schools, that free and reduced lunch rate. Well, as I learned over a period of months and months and months of interviewing teachers and school staff, social workers, healthcare workers, and interviewing parents, what I learned was that these were two completely different school neighborhoods, two different school environments. So I'd like to read just a couple. I didn't bring the PowerPoint. I presented on this work at AERA 2 years ago, and then a year later. The quote that we ended up using to kind of as a headline, if you will, is this. This is from a guidance counselor at the school that is part of a very, very depressed, socially isolated, high poverty school. The guidance counselor said to me one afternoon as we were standing outside the front office, observing, as I often do, dismissal of parent arrivals to pick up kids. She said to me, "We have so much here, Claire, and it still isn't enough." Meaning they could layer upon layer the social and health services at the school. But the neighborhood, the conditions in the neighborhood, were so challenging that it didn't ever seem to be enough. So two identical school types, two school enhanced option schools, fairly similar as it's the demographics and free lunch rates. What seemed to be the differences I learned over time was that one enhanced option school was nested close to a Hope 6 public housing project. And the other school was nested quite close to a traditional public housing project that had not been transformed by Hope 6. Let me read you a couple of the quotes from parents. First, from the traditional public housing here in Nashville, a public housing project. I'm not going to name them because I guarantee anonymity to the families. "I don't feel secure over there," this mother explains to me at the traditional public housing. "I don't go outside there. I don't even let her, my daughter, go outside there and play. The part where I live is terrible because sometimes there'll be a shooting during the daytime. They'll be out there fighting." This is the mother of a first grader. She's a part-time worker at Taco Bell and a part-time student at a local technical college. Here's another parent, mother of six children, a GED student. Her husband is ill with sickle cell and cannot work. "I can do better, and if I do what I need to do, I can get out of here. When you are surrounded by too many people that you know, there's going to be friction there, period. And it is so closely knit that anything can happen. Like when there's gunfire and we are so packed in together, there's nowhere to go. So it's good that I have a lot of family within, but it's bad because of the situation. And here's the perspective of a teacher. Yes?
Well, go ahead and finish your thought.
Okay.
Mine relates to somewhere.
Okay. Here's a perspective then of the teacher who teaches at the neighborhood school linked in proximity then to this traditional housing project. The kids come in from the weekend and tell me how this person has been shot in the middle of the street, how they have to run in and take cover. It is like a war, a battle over there in that neighborhood, and they are trying to survive. That is why we have so many young children trying to be the adult in the school, trying to lead. The problems that we have here are because over there in the neighborhood, they are learning to survive. Now remember, this is an elementary school. This is a K-4. Okay, now I just want to, do you want me to take a question? I'm going to contrast this with the other school.
Well, my question did have to do with the two schools. Which one was 82 and which one was 92%?
92 is the traditional public housing. 82 is the Hope 6.
Because it, although those numbers sound similar, if you flip it, you can think about how more than twice the number of kids in the near public housing school were, you know, moderate income or above. And maybe, you know, that's what's really important. There's a critical mass of, you know, moderate income families involved in that school.
Yeah. There's a critical mass of parents who are moving into kind of a new social milieu that has its own set of problems and challenges. But it certainly makes a difference in terms of the climate and social relations in that school. And you can think about what constitutes a tipping point.
Right.
Okay. Just quickly, that I want to share with you a couple of the impressions from the Hope 6 linked school. And I want to make this point, though. This is not Nirvana. Hope 6 families qualify for public housing. They are just at the edge of poverty status. I'll talk a little bit quickly here in a moment about Hope 6 and how you qualify to apply for a Hope 6 rental agreement. But as I want you to remember this quote for me. As one principal said to me, the Hope 6 parents, their problems haven't gone away. They just changed. They have a new set of challenges. All right. And in some ways, the same patterns of insularity and social isolation actually persist in Hope 6 for some important reasons. Okay, here are some voices then of parents in the Hope 6 project, the new Hope 6 project, whose children attend this elementary school. We all keep an eye on each other and each other's children. This is like living in Belle Mead to me. Some of you know what that means. Because where I come from, they were breaking in cars, breaking in houses, they were shooting each other. So she has a comparative view here. She's contrasting living in traditional public housing here in Nashville and then moving into a Hope 6. Okay. Here's another parent, though. Slight, look, note the characterization she paints. No, I don't know nobody because I ain't trying to get to know nobody. I just seen them coming out. I was staying in public housing before, and most people, everybody being your business, just so much folks you have to deal with. So I stay to myself. I don't even sit outside. For this mom, the patterns that she adopted, the patterns of resiliency, of survival that she had adopted in her earlier public housing project persist in the new Hope 6 project. Okay. Now, the final perspective here is the teacher's perspective at the school linked to Hope 6. Quote, I've never had so many working parents. I have never worked with as many working parents. I have seen a real difference in the attitude. Some teachers think the parents here are hard, demanding of things, and they are. They are more demanding, but I think it is because they are working so hard themselves that they want the very best. So this is still a hard scrabble life for them. They still have a tough life. Okay. Let's get to what is Hope 6 then. In 1992, Congress established the Hope 6 project as a response to a congressionally mandated study of public housing, which called 2/3 of it severely distressed. I think a very accurate, apt description. As of last year, HUD had awarded 224 Hope 6 grants to over 100 cities. The grants are made to the local housing authority. So here it's MDHA. They're not made to a state. They're made to the local housing authority. Okay. So what do we know about Hope 6? I mean, the first projects were established. The law was passed in 92. The first projects started coming online around 96. 1947. What do we know? Well, it's important for you to understand that most of the research has focused on families who are relocated as a result of a traditional public housing project being razed to the ground and rebuilt with far fewer units, because it's about lowering the density of public housing. So most of the research is, well, what happens to the displaced families? Do they get to move back in? Do they leave public housing forever? Do they move into other public housing? This is what we know. Most families who are displaced by new Project 6 who have to leave end up in three places. Most end up, it's only about 40%, that's not the majority, end up in other traditional public housing, the old dilapidated, densely populated, high crime public housing. The next highest group or number move into Section 8 housing. So they take a voucher and they get an apartment in a Section 8 building. The third group moves in or out. They move out of the city completely and we kind of lose track of them, or they move in with kin, extended kin, or family. Okay. Most of these studies are being conducted by the Urban Institute and by folks like the APT Associates Consulting Groups with a lot of support from HUD.
So is this understanding the numbers? Does the 40% represent the number that aren't allowed to return, or is that 40% that end up in public housing?
That's the group that must leave. 40% movement, yeah. Who comes back? Who are the returnees? Only a small percentage of original residents return. Why? Well, for one thing, Nashville is considered a leader in public housing. We are considered to have one of the finest, most professional, most efficient public housing authorities in the country. We're pretty good at this. The turnaround here is 3 to 4 years when the units are back up. Some cities like Baltimore, Pittsburgh, LA, Chicago, take years and years and years to get these places back up. So the families by then have moved and have reestablished themselves in these other arrangements that I described. The other key point here, though, that is critical to understanding HOPE 6 is the eligibility criteria. Who gets to move into HOPE 6? Okay. One, these are the issues. One, you have to have a good credit history. You can't have a lot of red flags on your credit report, and you cannot have a criminal history to move back into HOPE 6. All right, those are kind of minimum thresholds. HUD says to housing authorities, but you can even be more restrictive if you like. You can require, for example, the head of families, head of households, to be involved or engaged in work, school, combination, 40 hours a week, fully engaged, fully employed, fully involved in school. And that's what Nashville does. So Nashville is one of the most restrictive cities as far as HOPE 6 eligibility. We are actually from what I can get from HUD, maybe 20% of housing authorities use that most restrictive criteria. Most are saying no criminal history, gotta have a solid credit history. And by the way, family size is somewhat capped here because the biggest HOPE 6 unit can only accommodate a family of five. That's a parent for kids, assuming the structural arrangements.
Nashville is a little less restrictive in that, as I understand it, they allow 80% of the HOPE 6 to be occupied by public housing, and in other cities it's lower than that. So, because it's also about mixed income.
Right, right. That's right. I'll talk about that right now. Initially, HOPE 6 was all about just getting rid of this severely distressed housing stock and replacing it with far more attractive, handsomely landscaped, far less dense housing. Good housing where people could live and the quality of life would rise. Over time, what was interesting with this initiative is that mixed income became the mantra for HOPE 6. These have to be mixed income. Mixed income is the way to do this. So gradually, over time, HUD started awarding more and more of their HOPE 6 contracts to housing authorities that said, we can do this mixed income. And what that meant was that in any typical HOPE 6 project, 80% of the units would be rented at a subsidized rate for folks who 20% of the apartments, or really actually look like townhomes, would be rented at market rate. Market rate. In addition, there would be homes, single family dwellings, built around the perimeter or adjacent to the apartment units that would be sold at market value and market rates. Okay? So this was the mixed income initiative that slowly, but then predominantly, dominated Hope 6 policy after about 4, 5, 6 years. Okay, so all of this attention to the displaced family, a very important issue of social justice, equity, and access. I chose not to explore that specifically because it's being explored by the best folks, Popkin and others, in the field of housing research. What had not been addressed was what I was picking up in my study here in Nashville, was the significant role of Hope 6 neighborhood transformation and its trickle-down effects, or residual effects, on the school climate, on the social relations, on the levels of student engagement, patterns of parent involvement, and kind of the academic press of those neighborhood schools that were now absorbing the Hope 6 families.
Were you able to engage in your study with the kids who were in the traditional public housing school? To what extent those kids were kids who had been in other public housing and been displaced? So what I'm asking you about is sort of this inequity,
right,
where you have sort of the good public housing,
yeah,
and traditional public housing is now sort of for the worst of the worst.
Yes, it's really tough. None of the families that I encountered, interviewed, or followed had been displaced. Because of the displacement, it gets pretty thin. You have the receiving public housing, traditional public housing places. So, no, I did not. And it's not enough to really saturate any particular public, traditional public housing. Okay, so we argue, Carol and I, that Hope 6 then provides this critical context to test mixed income public housing policy on the educational inequalities that are typically associated with high poverty schools, or schools that are located in concentrated poverty and social isolation. All right, so here are research questions. And students don't have so many research questions when you do your dissertation. Okay, I'll just read them and then we'll just go on. What is the nature and quality of social interactions and social processes in Hope 6 and non-Hope 6, or the traditional public housing immigrants? So that's a little bit of these quotes, of the parent quotes, that I'm trying to get at. Patterns of social relations in those different public housing. Crime rates. We would be looking for, well, I won't tell you yet what we're going to look at. It's up here in just a second. How do these neighborhoods impact the neighborhood school in terms of student engagement, parent involvement, and the academic environment? Do safer, well, that's at least by crime reports, less dense, mixed income neighborhood environments lead to improved school environments for children and their families? So in sum, what are the side effects of neighborhood revitalization on neighborhood schools? Not explored explicitly. Okay, so neighborhoods matter. That's my conceptual, that's my title for the conceptual framework for students. What we turn to inform this study is the extant literature on neighborhood effects. And this is the literature that is from traditional urban sociology, from the Chicago School. This is the research literature involved in social area mapping, where we look at the infrastructure of neighborhoods, the housing stock, the proportion of abandoned to occupied housing, the condition of that housing, the kinds of streets and access to other vital arteries of the city, the demographics of a neighborhood, the institutions located in that neighborhood, from churches and community groups to community health centers and child care facilities. We move from those kinds of measures to an examination of the stuff that's hard to get to, but it's these social processes and social structures. So the argument is that neighborhoods function as the cultural and political and social webbing for families. This is not my argument. This is a long-standing assumption of neighborhood effects literature and urban sociology. Neighborhood environment defines the formation of particular social networks among families and the levels of trust, familiarity, and face-to-face. And here's some references. Brooks, Gunn, Duncan, Park, and Burgess, 1916. My gosh, how can we use that kind of literature? Because it's the classic literature on neighborhood effects, urban sociology, social area analysis. Okay. And this is more of the literature, and I would invite you to, and I have all of the references, and we have actually a full proposal that we can share with you. But this is the concentration effects, the social ecology literature, and as I said, the social disorganization theories, and these are the folks. So Carol and I are pulling from the relevant and appropriate literature that informs our study. These are not my claims or our claims. Okay. I think parents in high poverty neighborhoods may manage risk and opportunity by adopting stringent child monitoring and youth control or lockdown strategy. This comes from much of Frank Furstenberg's work from Northwestern, and it was certainly observed in these two studies. But what I wanted to underscore is it was also observed in the Hope 6 projects, again, as a strategy that was brought over for families who had adopted those strategies in traditional public housing. Community capacity, in kind of contrast to the old urban sociology stuff, community capacity is a more slightly more contemporary concept or more recent trend in the social science research. Community capacity refers to many of the elements that I talked about earlier, but it goes from structural to process to attitudes and behaviors and values and norms to levels of social trust. The nature of social networks in these neighborhoods. So we're always moving from the structural to the normative. Okay. Many folks in ed policy, in sociology of ed, my colleague Adam Gameron from University of Wisconsin, who is a collaborator actually with me on this, and he's a quantoid. And I'm a qualitative researcher, so it's an example of a quantoid and a qualitative researcher happily working together, actually. Adam spends a lot of time looking at high poverty schools and issues of tracking. We know a lot about high poverty schools are characterized by high rates of social disorder, higher mobility rates, lower attendance rates, and low rates of parent involvement. Okay. If you've taken social context with me, you know that this is a new trend in urban school reform. That is to accept the fact that neighborhoods are going to vary quite dramatically, differ deeply by socioeconomic status of those families. The idea then in Wake County, which is the home of Raleigh, North Carolina, was to mix up kids as they are assigned to schools. Wake County School Board said, we are not going to have any high poverty schools because we know that they can't be successful. And we have established a high benchmark for 100% of our kids at proficiency in 2007, 100% proficiency rate. So about 6 years ago, the Wake County School Board had been elected on this plank. There was a lot of business interest from the round table, said, we're going to adopt a socioeconomic integration policy. We're not going to deal with race because there have been too many appeals court rulings that disallow the use of race as a way of integrating kids. We're going to move away from race, like Charlotte has done. They have been using race under voluntary agreement. We're going to use socioeconomic status. And no school will have a free and reduced lunch rate higher than 40%. And we're going to know this beforehand by zoning the kids. We're going to know how to zone kids by creating an incredibly sophisticated data system where we know the background characteristics of all families using census and other data sources. So this is what Wake County has been doing. Cambridge, Massachusetts, doing a similar thing. It was catching fire, which means it was both catching a lot of attention and a lot of heat. And several school board members in Wake County have actually been voted off the board, even though
Very few families are affected by this. Many families are still zoned to what would be their neighborhood school. There's a little bit of shuffling, and in any given year in the fall, something like 4 to 6% of kids are rezoned to a different school to make sure they fall. They're underneath that 40% free and reduced lunch rate. Well, so is this a good idea?
One thing, Claire,
yeah.
The question, does that turn out to be just a proxy for race? In other words, if we had separated by race, would it pretty much come out to be the same?
It's a pretty good
distribution.
Proxy. Yes, it
yeah.
is. And they knew that, of course.
Yeah. We'll just call it something else.
I'm wondering, they're keeping under this threshold of 40%. What kind of variability do they have otherwise? I mean,
well, the rate, district rate
is 20%.
The district rate is 25%.
Okay.
It's decent, yeah. We know the tipping point is about 50. It's right about that half, so. Okay.
Ready?
Yeah. All right. So we have this parallel socioeconomic integration plan in schools where kids are rezoned so you get a school mix. But many would argue, look, the problem is not embedded in the schools. The problem and the challenge is embedded in neighborhoods. So let's think about addressing that issue. Well, as many of you have probably read, the Gautreaux Project in 1976 was one such effort. It arose from a federal housing desegregation suit. The Chicago Housing Authority was ordered by the court to desegregate and to improve the quality of the public housing. The experiment was hatched. The idea was launched. Let's move families then outside of Chicago to affluent suburban sites. Some families stayed in Chicago and remained in traditional public housing, and others were given a Section 8 voucher. And it was we could examine the effects of this. It was an experiment, social experiment. What did we find? Positive results, positive effects. The families who moved into affluent communities, by and large, benefited from the new social conditions and social structures in those affluent suburban communities. Their kids, on average, achieved at higher rates than the kids who remained in traditional public housing. Okay, late, yes?
So based on what? Based on scores or
yes,
grades?
Yes, scores.
Because the grades maybe even would go down in higher.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's right, it was test scores. Good point, excellent point. Under the Clinton administration, then Moving to Opportunity was launched in 1994. The intent was to replicate the findings, the results in the Gautreaux experiment. Moving to Opportunity, public housing reform is in five U.S. cities. It continues today. What do we know? The result, most recent results were published in a report, and they were summarized in Education Week back in, I believe, February. But I can get that reference for you if you'd like. Suggesting that children are doing no better academically in their suburban locations than are their counterparts who remained in public housing. Now why? Why this disappointing result in the Moving to Opportunity? Well, it turns out that rather than move to affluent areas, many of the children and their families moved to just slightly less poor communities. Maybe they had a extended kin member. The researchers, Brooks Gunn and others, argue that magnitude matters. The magnitude of reduction in poverty matters. So just simply moving kids over to a slightly less poor, maybe working class neighborhood will not generate the kinds of positive outcomes that we produced in the control.
Claire, again, is it just test scores? Is it differences in graduation?
Oh, it's a whole bunch of stuff. It is still test scores on the achievement, but academic performance in schools is only one measure. They look at crime, exposure to crime. They look at general quality of life and satisfaction. They look at employment issues, patterns of social interactions and social support. But on the academic measure, yes, it's a test score, and it's been disappointingly similar to their counterparts. Okay. That's Brooks Gunn. Go ahead. That's you.
Okay, folks. Well, as you can see, Claire has laid out a great conceptual framework for our proposal. I think we did okay on that part. I think it's, I'll probably have to be on the firing squad here, the methodology. So help us out here. I mean, any questions you have are going to be really appreciated. In order to address the questions that Claire has proposed, we propose to have a multi-case study, multiple mixed methodology to look at, to compare current Hope Six neighborhoods with the traditional public housing neighborhoods. And we proposed three different sites. So a year ago is when we were writing this up. We were on the phone with HUD all the time to try to find current Hope Six housing projects which would fit our criteria. We wanted to pick three cities in which there was a new Hope Six development, also a traditional public housing development that we could compare. We were going to pick Nashville as one. For example, Sam Levy, which we talked about, has just recently turned over, and that would have been a prime location for us. And we wanted to have these three different cities to be geographically diverse. We were going to pick one in the Midwest, Nashville, and one on the East Coast, I think it was. We wanted to go to the Bay Area of San Francisco, but we thought, well, maybe we couldn't quite justify that, so.
We had a different rationale
for
that.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, and we wanted to look at differing restrictiveness as far as eligibility requirements. As Claire pointed out, Nashville would have been one of the ones that would be most restrictive. And I think, and just looking at this and talking, hearing Claire talk about this, I think one of the huge things we have to look at is the residents, former residents who are left out, and just the fact that they are not coming back is bound to have a huge effect on the schools, the neighborhood interactions, and so forth, and possibly reduction in crime and so forth. Okay, so we were going to match then these sites, the Hope Six and the non-Hope Six, in each of these three cities, based on size, density, income level, and see, time-wise, okay. We're going to run through this quickly. Claire really has gone through what it is we're going to be looking at as far as what's in the neighborhoods. The infrastructure being the physical setup, are they townhouses, single family, et cetera, the architectural features, the demographics of residents, families, institutions, just as you mentioned, community centers, are they available, childcare, banks, groceries, et cetera. Social organization, these patterns of interaction among residents. Okay, and that would be the independent variable, and the dependent variable being the school effects, and we wanted to look at three different aspects of schools. Again, it would be elementary schools, and we would be focusing on, again, residents who have elementary school children. The academic environment, perceptions of safety, discipline, and orderliness. This would be perceptions of parents, of teachers, those involved. And academic press, that was a new term for me that I learned from Claire, and it's teachers' expectations, stringent expectations, stringent grading standards, and so forth. Best practices as we know it in education. Student engagement, including mobility, attendance, and so forth. All this we would get on the school-wide level, not individual. And parent involvement as far as volunteering in the schools, interacting with teachers, and so forth. So that's what we would be looking at. Here's how we plan to collect the data. This would be a four-year project, so we would have two waves of data collection 2 years apart. And we would start off with telephone surveys at these two-year intervals with, again, residents, all residents within these six different sites who have elementary school children in their homes. And that's a huge amount of the greater proportion of residents in these neighborhoods. Using an adaptive instrument from the HUD Residential Survey, and a parent involvement study that Ellen Goldring has worked on. Then we would have open-ended, in-depth interviews with randomly selected residents, 20 to 25 per site at, again, these same two-year intervals. And these would be residents, as Claire pointed out earlier, who had familiarity with the school, so their children were at least in second or third grade. Pretty much triangulating what we've already mentioned before, these same measures. And similar interviews with school personnel, teachers, and so forth to find out, again, parent involvement, their perceptions of safety, orderliness, etc., in the schools, student involvement, and so forth, as well as housing authorities and community agencies that are in the neighborhoods. We would look at documents, archival documents as far as census documents, school level achievement, mobility and attendance of kids, assignment to special and gifted ed programs, which is actually kind of interesting because in these high poverty neighborhoods, you tend to see lots of kids assigned to special education classes. We could get in, you know, a whole issue there. Are we just trying to remove them from the mainstream? And teachers' experience, teacher mobility, teacher attendance, which varies with income level of schools. We were planning to do pretty much traditional kind of qualitative data analysis, constant comparative methods, triangulating across different sources, and we called upon our statistician, who's Claire is friendly with, to help us with this aspect of looking at trying to find statistically significant differences across these sites. And this actually is the point that Joe brought out, that we could do looking at characteristics of neighborhood residents in a much more systematic fashion, based, of course, on the literature and so forth. And we're going to wind up here in a moment now. Contributions to policy and practice. Again, we have not found a study that has looked at neighborhood effects of restructuring on the school environment.
On the existing school, right.
Yes.
Some studies have looked at the new schools, new charter schools, for example,
mm-hmm.
that have been established in conjunction with a Hope 6 initiative. Well, that's a new school, part of this larger community revitalization. That's a different, interesting. But that's a different question. Oh, actually, they just looked at the first couple of years, how they were established, and in some cases, business developers were behind those new schools
mm-hmm.
in order to get folks like you and your wife to move into the mixed income area by establishing a really jazzy new charter school. Makes sense, but that's, again, not our interest. Our interest is in this spillover effect of the existing, on the existing school.
We should be interviewing this resident.
I know,
Hope 6 resident.
I found him in the hallway walking over here.
How are you doing?
Well, thank you.
Thank
all.
You all
that was,
very
that
much.
That was really helpful.
Thanks for coming.
I want to thank you guys for making the trip over here to our building. Carolyn's become a joint